From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Douglas Everett. 1 year ago today, New Orleans was ground zero for Hurricane Katrina. We discuss Katrina and her aftermath with a former resident of the Crescent City, today on Insight. We know smoking's bad, but children exposed to smoke fare worse than we thought, per a new study. And though Davis is not a place you'd expect to catch a spy, 20 years ago, the FBI did just that. Today's topics on Insight. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Douglas Everett, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. Today marks the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall at New Orleans. The powerful storm had skirted Florida without major harm, but regained strength over the Gulf of Mexico to become a Class 5 hurricane barreling down on New Orleans. Luckily for the city, Katrina weakened to a Class 4 storm as it struck the city, but as we all know, the damage was still catastrophic. A startled world was soon viewing photos of a chaos that ranked Katrina as a disaster of epic proportions. A lot has been written about Katrina's destruction and what was done or not done to prevent the flooding in the city, and of course, what happened in the aftermath. We have at Capital Public Radio someone from the area who can bear witness to what transpired to her former hometown, described by Truman Capote as one of the three great American cities, the other two being New York and San Francisco. Cheryl Dring is our music director here at CPR. She joins us today to tell us what she saw on a recent trip back to Louisiana and what she learned from relatives and friends who weathered the storm. This is not her first appearance on the show. She spoke about classical music with Jeffrey earlier this year. But Cheryl Dring, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks.
I'd like to note that Benjamin has put up some of your photos on our website, capradio.org/insight. So as we speak, listeners should be able to view those pictures that you took.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. I took a camera with me expecting that I would really want to document so much of what I saw. And when I got there, I didn't take many pictures. It somehow felt voyeuristic is perhaps not the word. But I was very aware as I walked around with the camera that this was somebody's home.
Yeah.
This was somebody's life, it just felt intrusive. So I took a few pictures. But not as many as I had thought. But even from the few, it's obvious what's going on. The other thing about not taking so many pictures was that I realized how really limited I was in being able to show the scope of what had happened with still photos. I really, at that point, wished that I had a video camera and a mic and could just, you know, drive and show the real extent of it. Because one shot here or there, you just don't get any idea of the immensity.
Well, I've got some of these photos in front of me. I'm itching to talk about some of them. But let's do a little background. New Orleans is actually your city of your birth.
Yes. I was born there and had the strange fortune of growing up in the northern part of the state, which is really much more like East Texas, but then moved back down to the southern part of the state for graduate school and just kept sliding south to New Orleans, felt that pull.
And you, I guess, visited the Crescent City throughout your childhood?
Oh, yeah. Loved it. It's a seductive city. I think with a lot of great cities, it's I've heard people who respond to cities one way or the other. There doesn't seem to be much middle ground. People either love it or they just don't get why people like it. They say it's a big, dirty city. You know, there are poor people there. The infrastructure is crumbling. What's wonderful about it? But if you're there and you're bitten by the bug, most people never leave.
Well, that's why I wanted to mention that Truman Capote quote because, you know, in the few occasions I visited, it reminded me of what I was calling, I called it a flat San Francisco because it seemed to have a certain something.
Right. You know, and people ask me since I've moved here, so this must be a real change for you. I mean, what do you notice most about it? And I said, you know, It's the funky factor. Yeah, I love California, and Sacramento is a great warm place to live. But when I need a little funky factor, I go over to San Francisco and drive around the Haight a little bit, and get that feeling again. But people just spill into the street. I mean, their spirit in that city is just out there all the time.
Well, it's certainly a major city for tourism. I mean, they hold conventions there. They hold Super Bowls there. I mean, it's not your average town.
No, it's not. And, you know, I always encourage people when they say, oh, I'm going to New Orleans for a conference or a convention, say, get out of the French Quarter. Don't just stay around your hotel and do the touristy things. Get out into the city. Get into the neighborhoods. Like a lot of great cities, New York and San Francisco, it's very neighborhood-centered. And there are a lot of people who pretty much live their lives in their neighborhoods, the suburbs. You know, they're talking about going into the city like it's mounting an expedition. But the cities the neighborhoods are very contained. You have your markets, your restaurants, the churches, and all of the community that grows up. And a lot of people, generation after generation, in the same neighborhood. So the neighborhoods have their own characters.
So do you have friends and family throughout those various neighborhoods of the city?
Several of them. Mm-hmm. My family is all elsewhere in the state, but having lived there for 8 years in New Orleans proper, you develop your own sense of community. And being a musician, I knew the musicians, and so I know the neighborhoods where the musicians live. But it's very interesting, and from neighborhood to neighborhood, the city has such a different character. And a lot of the people I know live in the uptown area. And so we're somewhat shielded from the devastation of their houses, but the devastation of the city still is impacting them. And I had a number of friends who lived out in the lakefront area, which, as most people know, suffered a lot of damage.
That's where Lake Pontchartrain basically came over the levees there.
Yeah, it's interesting if you followed what happened, is it wasn't really the hurricane that that flattened the city. It was the levee breaches, and so all that water that it was pushing weak places in the levee, and boom, there it was. So it wasn't the lake coming out. It was really the industrial canal and the canals that the water came through and poured into the neighborhoods. And there are places where the levees breached that you can see right around the breaches where the houses were just pretty well wiped out.
Well, I think everyone saw that footage on CNN and elsewhere about just how bad it was. I mean, uprooted trees. I mean, it looks thoroughly devastated in some areas, but I'm gathering that it's very piecemeal. Some places are wiped out and others are weathered it pretty well.
Pretty well. The places that... What struck me was after 11 months, how much it looks like it could have been just a few weeks ago because of how widespread the damage was. And you begin to notice little markers. I wanted to make a point of not going in as a tourist, but I went in to stay with friends who lived out by the lake and who are still in the process of trying to put their house back together. It had about 3 or 4 feet of water in it. But for 2 weeks, so you're thinking it sits there in water and sludge and horrible things for 2 weeks. But just a few blocks away, one of the pictures we have of a friend's house here had about 7 feet of water in it. And they called me when they got back to the house in October, called me from the front porch on the cell phone as they were going into the house, and said that the furniture had just disintegrated. It had sat in water so long that the glue had given up, and
wow,
just everything had sort of fallen into sticks. So
I'm looking at this photo, and we were going to post these, of course, as I mentioned, on our website. Mm-hmm. This is your friend's house, the one with the X basically on it. Mm-hmm. And the roof, is that damaged the roof from people climbing up on it, or is that just the wind and...
That just wind and rain there. They had evacuated, so they were out of the house.
They weren't like those people we saw in the pictures that were up on their roof waiting for helicopters to...
Exactly. You know, the interesting thing about the city, and I've heard so many people say, why didn't they leave? Why didn't they leave? And I think there are a couple of answers to that. One is that a lot of the people that we saw the footage of couldn't leave. that people who are living less than paycheck to paycheck, and it's a matter of, okay, we're taking a risk here. Do we buy groceries this week, or do we, you know, do we buy a bus ticket to get out of town? And when you live in New Orleans, you develop a sense of, I guess, fatalism, that what's going to happen is going to happen, because there are several hurricanes usually a year that come through. And so if you evacuate for every one, you spend a lot of time on the road, and it takes you 12 hours to go a four-hour drive, and then you get back, and people go, I'm not doing that again. And so,
as I recall, there have been a couple sort of false alarms before that.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And so a lot of the people who've lived there for a long time are like, oh, yeah, I'd rather stay here, and, you know, we'll be without power for a couple of days, and it'll be hot, but I won't be stuck in traffic. And so that's the mindset of, I'd rather weather it here. It's going to be terrible. We'll be without power. It'll be hot. It'll be rainy, but I won't have to fight the traffic. And so it was the levee breaches that made this different, not the hurricane.
But sure, I'm looking at this other photo. You mentioned how, you know, we'll weather the storm, but looking at this one picture, you've got what looks like just the frame of a house. It almost looks burned out. It's just thoroughly,
it is.
It was burned.
Mm-hmm. That's the other thing that happens in situations like this, is there's so much subsidence, and you get broken gas lines. And so you also get fires in the middle of floods, which is a very strange sight.
In this photo, there's a wheel hanging up, sticking out of the side of the building above the car. Is that just from something that was lifted up and smashed into the?
It looks like, to me, maybe it's a trailer for something.
Yeah.
This is just a house I passed in that same neighborhood, but I was so struck by the fact that a lot of the trees, which for sitting 2 weeks in salt water, a lot of the trees were killed. Mm-hmm. And so there's this very strange sense of desolation in some of these neighborhoods. And you think, it was 11 months as I was driving through there. And on some streets, you see 2, 3, maybe 4 FEMA trailers, and people are trying to sort of put the houses back together. But there'll be block after block of just nothing. It's as if people have walked away.
You talked about how difficult it is to basically try and be a photojournalist. And I know that when you go to foreign countries, you wind up taking pictures of the quaint things that you don't have at home. But how representative is this photo of, I mean, how, what percentage would you say of the city of New Orleans looks like this photo?
You know, I'm not even sure I could guess, because it's a matter of whether you're talking about the city proper, whether you're continuing on with the Ninth Ward and St. Bernard and out that way. I think some of the numbers, and I'm just talking off the top of my head here because I'm not a historian or a scientist. I think there were numbers thrown around of 80% of the city was affected in some way as far as flooding. But the neighborhood that we're showing here, these were neighborhoods that had 6, 7, 8 feet of water. There were some areas of the city that reported up to 20 feet of water.
You know, one of the things, I don't know whether you know about this, I was reading at one point they were talking about basically getting rid of Charity Hospital, which is such a big institution in New Orleans, famous for its tropical medicine and things. Are they going to go through with closing it?
I don't know. It was still completely shuttered when I was there. And these are the problems that you don't think of. And it was very, as I said earlier, it was important to me to not be there as a tourist, but to live with a family and get some idea of what the daily reality was like. And the friends that I stayed with had a 5-year-old, and you think, boy, that also puts it in a different perspective there of having a child in the midst of this just depressing scene around you. And they were living in the upstairs of their house. Luckily, it was large enough that they had an upstairs to live in. But in driving around in the neighborhoods one day out the Ninth Ward, St. Bernard, around through New Orleans East and back up around Lakeview, I drove for about an hour and didn't see a grocery store or a gas station open. So just
makes it pretty tough to function with.
The little things like that. I had a flat tire while I was there. The streets are in such bad shape because of the amount of time they spent underwater. The streets in New Orleans were in bad shape anyway. but it was raining, of course, as it does in New Orleans when I was there. Hit a place where the street had buckled, blew out a tire, and it took 3 days for me to get a tire. So
You're just getting a taste of what people have been describing of the difficulties.
The difficulty of day-to-day living, I think, is the main thing that's wearing on a lot of people. And there are some people that all they can talk about is the storm, and some people who don't want to talk about it.
Well, it's been such a controversial thing, what happened in the wake of Katrina, the relief efforts or the disorganization, the chaos, how inadequate some people found them to be. When you talk to people, do you think people you spoke with, are they angry or bitter about what happened, about the relief effort?
They're furious.
Really?
They're furious, and they continue to be furious at their sense of inertia, the number of things that they feel could have been, should have been addressed that haven't. Streetcars aren't running because the streetcar lines along St. Charles have to be repaired. There are things that people take as part of everyday life in New Orleans that just aren't working anymore. Some of the neighborhoods that you see don't have power yet. I have a friend who works for the cable company, and she says there are people who call on a regular basis and just chew her out because they finally managed, you know, to get back into their neighborhood and they don't have cable. You know, so you lose your sense of perspective, I think, about what's important and what isn't. But I think people are so at the edge of frustration with everything being difficult.
See, when I asked that question, I didn't really have in mind how reverberating this remains. I sort of had the feeling that people were complaining about the immediate aftermath what's going on. But this is continued right to the present day with a day-by-day dissatisfaction with how things have not been fixed.
Exactly. There are all sorts of things that are contingent on other things. A lot of people who are waiting to rebuild their houses until they get the flood maps, until they know whether they can get flood insurance. There are people who are paying mortgages on houses they can't live in. So you've got to live somewhere in the meantime. There are areas that still don't have power back. And the people who are still, who do have power now, complain that their power bills are out the roof. So there's so much that's interwoven that of trying to get that fabric back of everything hanging together.
Some people have been arguing in the wake of what this huge disaster that, well, perhaps they shouldn't rebuild some areas of New Orleans. Of course, the areas that were hit hardest were the lowest ones. The higher ground was taken earlier, had better housing, people that were better off. Others are saying that's a racist view, that poor black neighborhoods need to be restored too. Which side do you think is carrying the day in the argument?
Well, I have to say there's one thing that makes me a little angry. And I understand how it happens. A lot of the coverage we saw looks like that this fell along racial lines, and to a great extent it did. But a lot of the neighborhoods that you see that are totally destroyed are working class neighborhoods, mixed neighborhoods, white neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. So it's not strictly a racial issue. And it's been portrayed that way a lot, that it was the poor black people who were really penalized in this, and the affluent whites got off okay. And there are some aspects of that, but as we see with Lakeview, these are teachers, nurses. It's a racial mix, and some affluent neighborhoods along the lakefront. A neighborhood maybe that you would compare to the fabulous 40s. Big houses, posh lots. You know, so those were pretty well wiped out, too. I was trying to describe to someone, if you took Sacramento, and I've been actually looking for a map that I could overlay to get some idea. Mm-hmm. But if you took Old Sac and said, okay, Old Sac is pretty much intact. Parts of downtown are okay. The main bit of downtown, as you get to the fringes, there was some water. About half of Midtown made out all right. The rest of Midtown got, a couple of feet of water. Tahoe Park, 7-8 feet of water. Elk Grove, pretty much wiped out. Roseville took some water. So you begin to get a sense of the scope of it. So I think the discussion of it along racial lines doesn't help advance the discussion of, let's look at the terrain that we're dealing with. Right. Let's look at what the earth is telling us we can and can't do here. And I think that's a lot of it, is the idea of what is it possible, first of all, to reclaim and to protect. So there's that cost-benefit analysis at some point, and nobody wants to talk about it because you're talking about people's homes.
Yeah, One thing, if we had more time, I'd like to ask about this ultimate question of why they didn't basically rebuild all the wetlands, all of the areas around it, which were acting as a barrier. But that's going to cost billions and billions of dollars. And I just, once the year has passed now, you're not hearing about that anymore. Are people still concerned about, you know, actually doing that?
You know, they need to be, and I think they're not as concerned as they should be. If you look at maps of New Orleans now, and you see Lake Pontchartrain, pretty hard not to see it, big old lake there, the thin strip of land that separates it from the Gulf, and we're talking freshwater lake, saltwater Gulf, we're losing that strip of land, and this storm did a lot of damage there, so the saltwater intrusion was a problem, and also lost about 80 square miles of coast the day that the hurricane struck.
Wow. I went on the website to see what people are saying about this a year later, and there seems to be some cautious optimism by a lot of people's parts on this. The city naturally is going to want to say, sure, come on back. Things are great. The food's still here. The music is still here. You know, the city is not going to go away. Please come back. Would you recommend to our listeners that they go?
Yeah. You know, we were there at the end of July with a public radio conference, and I was so glad to be able to take some of my coworkers and show them the city I love. Make them eat the good food. Let them go to the little neighborhood clubs where people are playing music, and you get a sense of why that city will come back. It's because there's nothing else quite like it, and the people who make it what it is are not going to give it up easily.
Well, Cheryl, thanks for giving us a personal perspective on Katrina and the rebuilding that's going on down there in New Orleans.
Happy to.
Cheryl Dring is Capital Public Radio's music director. You're listening to Insight. We'll talk next about a proposal to make smoking in a car with small children illegal. Is this sensible legislation or overzealous government meddling? That after a short break. I'm Douglas Everett, sitting in for Jeffrey Callison. As a physician, I've been frustrated over the years the terrible toll cigarettes take on the health of patients. Smoking is implicated in the demise of 500,000 Americans every year, which is more than we lost in World War II. And what about those exposed to the cigarette smoke of others, children in particular? A new study by UC Davis researchers on developing lungs indicates the situation is more alarming than we have known. Joining us to talk about this recent research is UC Davis Professor of Pediatrics, Dr. Kent Pinkerton. Welcome to Insight, Dr. Pinkerton.
Thank you.
Well, we've long suspected that smoking was bad for developing lungs, but the jury more and more now seems to be in on the matter. What did your group discover?
We were interested in trying to understand what could be happening during early development of the lungs. And we were specifically interested in trying to understand what was creating airway hyperreactivity that creates an asthmatic-like condition in children. However, much to our surprise, we found that there were other events that were occurring during the same time. And one of them is that those signals that control cell growth, cell differentiation, were actually being disrupted by exposure to secondhand smoke. And in essence, what we found that in 2-month-old infant monkeys, that we were seeing a doubling of cell death in the cells that are forming the alveoli at a time when we should have very rapid, robust proliferation of these cells forming new alveoli. This is actually quite important because we actually form 80% of our alveoli after we're born. And during a time such as this, when we actually are disrupting that process, that could have far-reaching consequences.
Well, we seem to be seeing like a worldwide increase, and here in the United States as well, in asthma. Is this playing a role, do you think, in that? It's been a mystery for quite a while.
We have been very interested in that question. In fact, we've spent the last 15 years trying to address whether secondhand smoke could be impacting on that process. What we have found is that exposure during critical windows of development that include both during the gestational period prior to birth and immediately following birth, that there are factors that appear to be playing a role there which cause the lungs to develop hyperreactive airways or a ticklish airways that would be reminiscent of an asthmatic-like condition.
Well, are you finding you're getting a lot of inquiries in regards to this research?
Yes. We've actually been very pleased with being able to do this research. One of our goals was to be able to get this information out into medical journals that would be on the shelves of pulmonary physicians. Although we are basic scientists, and this study is very much looking at the basic mechanisms of the effects of secondhand smoke, we felt that this was really a critical information that we needed to get into the hands of pulmonary physicians who are practicing every day, who may be involved and who could be influential in helping people to better understand some of the unknown aspects of secondhand smoke on children's health.
Well, Dr. Pinkerton, what would you recommend people do if they smoke and have children, which I'm sure includes quite a few of our listeners?
My recommendation would be to minimize as much as possible exposure to secondhand smoke. It's only being logical. I think what I would say has been said many times over, but I think from our perspective, we're beginning to realize even more so that exposure during pregnancy to secondhand smoke, as well as direct exposure of children when they're very young to secondhand smoke, is not a beneficial consequence.
Well, we're about to talk about some legal solutions, potential solutions to the problem, specifically in a moment about a bill that's going to ban smoking in automobiles if small children are in the car. Where would you stand on that suggested remedy?
My initial gut reaction to that would be that it sounds good, especially for children who are under the age of 8 years. I think that it's during that particular period of time from birth to 8 years of age that these children are most susceptible to the effects of secondhand smoke. But if we had to be even more specific, I would say if you could protect children who are 2 years of age or younger, that that is the most critical group of children who need to be protected from smoke. And if that smoke is arising from being inside a car where the concentrations could reach levels that would be significant, I would be in favor of such legislation.
Well, Dr. Kent Pinkerton, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Pinkerton's research group has been studying the effects of environmental contaminants on unborn and newborn animals for 15 years. Their efforts were published in last month's American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. California Assembly Bill 379 is currently making its way through the legislature. Sponsored by Assemblyman Paul Koretz, Democrat from West Hollywood, the bill would prohibit motorists from lighting up in their cars if children are present. Joining us to talk about AB 379 is Assemblyman Paul Koretz. Welcome to Insight, Assemblyman Koretz.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be on.
What led you to propose this legislation?
Well, actually, it happened when I was at a meeting of individuals who had been involved in smoking-related issues, and they were eulogizing Marco Feuerbach, who had originally proposed such legislation. And as we were talking, I said, well, you know what? I really should pick up this bill, which is his greatest legacy and his most significant legislation, and sponsor it on the assembly floor, particularly not only in his honor, but the fact that there have been studies since the bill was defeated when Marco carried it that have shown greater impacts of secondhand smoke upon all individuals than we thought, a more serious impact of secondhand smoke in small and close places like cars, and studies that have shown a greater impact upon young lungs. And so it seemed logical that this was the time to do it, both in recognition of Marco, who had died young and tragically, and the greater research that's been done to show just how damaging secondhand smoke can be. And also, since it was first proposed, two states have adopted similar legislation.
Well, Assemblyman, how can you summarize how the details would work on your bill, 379? Are you there? Well, it appears we may have lost Assemblyman Paul Koretz.
No, I'm here.
Okay. Well, Assemblyman, how would you summarize the details on this? How would this work per your bill?
Well, if a law enforcement officer saw someone with small children of the age in which they would need a car seat, which is 6 years old and younger, smoking in a car, they could pull them over. The first time would be a warning, and after that it would be a $100 fine.
Well, there have been some similar efforts here in California. You mentioned these previous ones. How do you handicap the odds of AB 379?
I think the chances are good because all the research has shown the impacts of secondhand smoke are greater upon all individuals and upon younger children than was once thought. The fact that this has now been done in other states, I think that all bodes well for the bill, which didn't fail by that large a margin. I think this year we'll be able to do it.
Well, what do you say to people who feel that the efforts to restrict smoking around kids in a car is just going too far?
Well, they really said that about just about every effort to restrict smoking, from creating smoking and non-smoking sections, which was revolutionary 20 years ago but now is totally passé, to banning smoking in restaurants and bars and nightclubs. All of that, people said, would be very hard to enforce, was unrealistic, and now it's generally those efforts are universally acclaimed, and enforcement has been very easy. It's been very self-enforcing. I don't think this measure goes any further than those previous health protection measures, and I don't think it'll be any harder to enforce.
Well, we will certainly follow its progress through the legislature and see what happens. It's a very interesting bill. We thank you for speaking with us, Assemblyman Koretz.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Paul Koretz represents West Hollywood in the California Assembly. There's no doubt that this bill in the legislature certainly has the best of intentions, but not everyone is convinced that making it illegal to smoke in a car with children present really is such a good idea. Joining us now is Dr. Lee Welter. Dr. Welter is with our local Libertarian Party, where he serves as the secretary. Libertarian Party, of course, is in general opposed to governmental restrictions on personal behaviors. And I'd like to thank you to Insight, Dr. Welter.
I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Is the Libertarian Party officially opposing this bill?
I don't believe that the Libertarian Party has taken any official position. And furthermore, I cannot speak on behalf officially of the Libertarian Party, nor necessarily of all libertarians, but I can reflect the libertarian philosophy, which, as you suggested, prefers that individuals have the authority and take responsibility for their own actions and their consequences rather than being micromanaged by government. However, we believe that an appropriate role is the protection of public safety, and certainly who can argue that the health of children is not a public safety issue? So I sort of fall on the side of favorable. If you need some unfavorable commentary, I gleaned some from our local newspaper.
So you actually are more favorable in this bill than what most people in the Libertarian Party, the position of most people.
I have seen the consequence of smoking through a lengthy career as an anesthesiologist, and I also learned some things that are not readily apparent to everybody, in that nicotine is a very powerful psychoactive drug. It benefits the people that use tobacco products. In terms of their psyche, it is a part of their stress coping behavior. I could elaborate on that, but I know we don't have a lot of time here.
Well, I would inject that I was a registered libertarian myself for years. I have a lot of sympathy for the philosophy, but on the other hand, of course, as a doc, I remember being an intern here at the medical center, seeing patients being brought in with asthmatic attacks, pediatric patients again and again and again having attacks. Their parents were smoking, and we'd ask, "Do you smoke around your child?" And they'd say, "Well, he's just, you know, yeah, he's just one kid just one person in the family. We have rights too." And I always thought of it as a sort of a form of child abuse. But as a doctor, how would you balance off the rights of the smoker versus the rights of the young children? It's a tough one.
I'd say use some of the devices that were introduced at least 25 years ago, ashtrays that take the excess smoke and filter it before the air is processed and released back into the room. In a fancy restaurant once where you could grill your own steaks, I put the exhaust fan over the grill on, consequent to somebody lighting up their cigar at the next table. In my perception, most adults, particularly in California, are pretty fastidious about stepping outside their homes onto the patio or the porch to light up their cigarette, though they're long-term dedicated smokers, particularly when they have children or non-smokers in their dwelling or in their vehicles. And consequently, you might ask, how many vehicles are there currently on the road that contain small children or young children that might be subject to this legislation? I question that. I suspect somebody's probably done a survey already, and there may be an answer to that. There are some other potentially unintended or unanticipated consequences that one might question. I can elaborate if you wish.
Well, unfortunately, we're running against it on time.
Sure.
I wish we had more time, but Dr. Welty, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Lee Welty represents the Libertarian Party here in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight. When you think of spies, you might think of Berlin, Vienna, Moscow, but you don't think of a trailer park in Davis. But that's where the trail of one of the biggest espionage cases of the Cold War led 2 decades ago. We'll talk about that after a short break. Tomorrow on Insight, learn why a local independent filmmaker is pulling up stakes. Later this week, author Lisa Teasley talks about her new book, Heat Signature. And Sacramento High School celebrates its 150th anniversary. 20 years ago today, in federal court in San Francisco, Jerry Whitworth of Davis was sentenced to 365 years in prison for his role in what international headlines had referred to as the Walker family of spies. Until his arrest in 1985, John Walker had, for 17 years, sold the KGB the keys they needed to read the encoded communications of the whole U.S. Navy. Furthermore, after he himself retired from military service as a communications officer, John Walker talked his brother, son, and most importantly, friend Jerry Whitworth into supplying him with fresh secrets to sell the Soviets. It was, by all accounts, one of the most important spy rings in the history of the Cold War, in part because it lasted nearly 2 decades undetected and largely unsuspected. The first clue anyone had that secret U.S. military codes were compromised came with a letter postmarked from Sacramento, which came to the San Francisco office of the FBI in May 1984. Joining us today to talk about that letter and what followed is the man to whom it was directed, former Special Agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, John Peterson. Agent Peterson was doing counterintelligence work for the FBI when this provocative note was handed to him. We're pleased to have him join us from the studios of KUNR in Reno, Nevada. John Peterson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, you had a 29-year career with the FBI, 10 years in counterintelligence. Was this your most remarkable case?
It was certainly among the most significant and certainly the highest profile case I ever was involved with.
Well, after all the spy ring members were rounded up, they were incarcerated, a damage assessment was done, revealing that it had been very successful. What did the Soviets gain from what Walker and Whitworth sold them?
Soviet defectors have told us that they read over 1 million messages of radio traffic, individual messages between U.S. naval vessels and shore installations. By reading that much traffic, they were able to get a very keen insight into the strategy and tactics of our Navy, particularly ballistic submarines, surface warships, and the installations onshore that support them.
So my understanding is, had the Cold War turned hot at any point, the Soviets would have known exactly the positions of all of our vessels and would have had an incredible advantage.
They certainly would have had a significant advantage. And again, Soviet defectors have told us in the past that their policymakers considered this.
My understanding also is that it was the Pueblo incident, a famous incident in the 60s. The North Koreans seized an NSA spy ship. It basically gave the USSR the hardware for U.S. military communications. But a lot of people, I think, felt that that wasn't so bad. They really couldn't use it unless they were supplied what were called key lists, but that in fact is what Walker and Whitworth supplied the Russians.
That's correct. There was also another device that was subsequently used in conjunction with that piece of machinery that was also compromised by the Walker, by John Walker to the Soviets, as well as the key lists that were furnished over a period of 20 years.
So it's 1984. You're handed this mysterious letter. The author alleged in it that he called himself Russ, alleged he'd been passing secrets to the Soviets. And in reading about this, I was struck by the fact that the FBI has to field volumes of such communications, alleging all sorts of dramatic things, and that it's a significant problem trying to sort out what is credible data from crank calls, crank letters. Public perhaps doesn't really even ponder this matter, but it's understand that's really quite a sticky problem.
Yes, it is. It was. You get a lot of nut letters, as they're called, or crank letters. This one had a particular ring of veracity to it because of the terms that were used in it, because of the syntax. It just struck me as being valid.
Just sort of a feeling you had, but regarding how it was phrased, or
yeah, and some of the terms that were used in there, like tech manuals and key lists, those are things that not everybody knows about unless you're in the military or you're involved in a counter intelligence or an intelligence agency.
Well, Russ sent you one letter. He then sent a couple of follow-up letters. Which were then given to psychological experts at the FBI. And, of course, we've learned that people like Ted Kaczynski was a famous example of what you could learn by analyzing what a person writes. What do the experts conclude about Russ?
We had a linguistics expert look at the letter, and he made some general estimations or evaluations about it. I think quite similarly to the way that serial murderers are profiled. In the final analysis, it really wasn't that useful to the investigation.
Well, a few months after you were pondering who Russ might be, out on the East Coast, John Walker's wife was trying to tell the FBI what her husband was up to, but she was not at all credible. She was apparently intoxicated telling this fantastic story. But I gather an FBI counterintelligence expert got wind of it, and he too judged it to be legitimate, breaking the case.
Yes, that's correct. In Norfolk, Virginia, they started, where John Walker was living at the time, they started investigating him, listening to his telephone calls, and they watched him for, I believe, several months before he ultimately, one weekend, got in his car and drove up to up to Washington, D.C., to the Maryland suburbs, where he had several hundred classified documents and left them in a what we call a dead drop. And a Soviet KGB officer from the embassy in Washington, D.C., was supposed to pick it up and leave a sum of money for Walker. This occurred, I believe it was around May 20th of 1985, and Walker was arrested in the early hours of that Sunday morning.
So, and by this point, I gather you'd figured out that his confederate on the West Coast was Mr. Jerry Wentworth of Davis.
Yes, and we put it together rather quickly after, just before John Walker's arrest. But after his arrest, it was very, there was a sense of urgency about getting out and interviewing Jerry Wentworth, because the news was going to be out on the radio. In fact, during the interview, Whitworth turned on his radio, and that was the headline of the hour, was the arrest of John Walker.
Well, you went in there and handed him the Rust letter and said, "I think you wrote this." Well, how did he react?
That was after about an hour or so of a lot of self-serving foolishness about his and Walker's relationship. I finally pulled out one of the letters and I handed it to him and I said, "I believe you wrote this." And he started visibly shaking and said, I don't want to say anything more without an attorney present." So that was the end of the interview.
And I at this point, I suppose you pretty much knew you had your man. No, I guess there was not much doubt about it before that.
No, there was quite a bit of information coming from Walker's ex-wife and his daughter, who he'd tried to recruit as a spy. And so this information was coming together, and it pointed directly at Jerry Whitworth.
Well, you're in the trailer park in Davis. You're pretty sure you've got Whitworth dead to rights, but the FBI did not take him into custody right at that moment. You had to check with the Justice Department. How does that work in espionage cases?
Well, at the time, and I believe it's still the case, U.S. Department of Justice has to authorize the arrest for espionage and perhaps some other crimes of that magnitude. But this was done by an attorney in Washington, D.C., who was head of that of the espionage section at the Department of Justice. And this was a decision he alone had to make. It was not left up to those of us in the field in Sacramento or in San Francisco to be specifically arrested for espionage. That had to come from back east.
So you basically kept him under surveillance at that point, just to make sure he couldn't flee.
Yes, we searched his house with his consent, and at the time he was composing a letter on his computer to John Walker, which he during the interview he'd left the room for a minute and tried to hide that letter, but the agent I was with followed him, and he wasn't able to do that. So we got that was very incriminating evidence, along with some other things. For example, he had asked us to communicate with him using the Monday LA Times edition in the personal ad section. And we found a number of Monday editions of the LA Times on his back porch. So that was kind of incriminating, hard to explain.
Well, apparently Walker pled guilty to his case, but Whitworth decided to fight it, so they brought Jerry Whitworth out to the coast, and you wound up guarding John Walker for his court appearances. Did you ever get any sense from him of remorse or anything that he'd done?
No, John was anything but remorseful. He looked at the whole situation as a big game between the East and the West, and he just saw this as a way for him to profit by that game, called intelligent counterintelligence, in essence, the Cold War. I'm sure he was sorry he got caught, but he was a total sociopath. He had no conscience at all about any damage that he would have done, and he did plenty of damage.
Well, there was an episode of American Justice on this case. They interviewed a lot of people involved with it, some of the back east people that arrested Walker. And it struck me that this is a case involving the Navy, the Pentagon, intelligence agencies, the FBI's investigating it. And yet when it came to the trial of Jerry Whitworth, where they really nailed him was with the IRS, knowing exactly where he'd spent the money.
That's right. The Criminal Investigation Division of the IRS, they're involved in other criminal investigations such as drug trafficking and money laundering. And that was the group that went after Whitworth's spending for the past 10 years. And they could tell you almost on a daily basis where he spent his money, what he bought, where he bought it, what day it was. It was really quite a diary of his activities for the past 10 years, and that's really what there was no doubt after that he was guilty, and he'd spent several hundred thousand dollars that he couldn't account for.
Well, John Peterson, we thank you very much for speaking with us. It's the most interesting case, and I wish we had more time to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
John Peterson was a special agent of the FBI from 1969 until 1998. For over 2.5 years, he worked on the Walker-Whitworth espionage ring. That's it for Insight. Jeffrey Callison's back tomorrow. You can hear him tonight on KXPR from 6 to 8 p.m., where he's sitting in for Cheryl Dring. Insight's producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Associate producer is Jen Picard. Yours truly can be heard on KDVS's Radio Parallax, 90.3 FM, every Thursdays at 5. Thank you for listening.
Next time in Insight, learn why a local independent filmmaker is pulling up stakes. Plus, Pluto is no longer considered a planet. How will this affect a local planetarium and astrologists? Also, you'll hear how the California Department of Forestry protects historical sites during forest fires. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.